I'd like now to welcome Donald Neidig. He is a retired solar astronomer and astrophysicist from the National Solar Observatory, and he will be speaking a week from today, the 10th of September, leading a discussion called Understanding Global Warming. It's the first in this season's Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, and it's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex on Grant Avenue. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. It's just great to have you. Now, how long have you been studying global warming and climate change?
I've been interested in it for years because it's a good astronomy problem. After I retired about 10 years ago, I spent a great deal of time doing the primary research literature to find out exactly what's going on rather than just relying on news clips and things like that.
What do you mean when you say it's a great astronomy problem?
Well, there's this issue of why is it that planets have temperatures that they do? And there's more to it than just the amount of sunlight that falls upon them. And this has been known for a long time. And Venus is an outstanding example. For example, Venus should actually be cooler than Earth if you just looked at the amount of solar radiation because it reflects so much of its light from its clouds. But actually, the surface temperature is like 700 degrees Celsius. I'm on a Kelvin scale here, about 700 degrees Kelvin, which is much, much warmer than Earth. And the question is, why is that? And it's been known for quite some time. It's the greenhouse effect, because Venus has an atmosphere that's very dense in greenhouse gases.
What kind of gases are in Venus's atmosphere?
It's like 90-something percent carbon dioxide.
So that in itself is a bit of an object lesson for us, I suppose.
Indeed so. You know, on Earth, the carbon dioxide concentration is about 400 parts per million. So it's just a trace gas in Earth's atmosphere. And Earth also has water vapor, which is a strong greenhouse gas.
So what are the tools that you use? What do scientists measure when they're measuring global temperature?
Well, the thing that the public sees most often is what is known as global surface temperature, which is an average of air temperature over land and sea surface water temperature, or air temperature over the surface of the water. So that's really just a small sample of the entire climate system. And they measure changes in temperature over the years at many points over the surface of the Earth, so that the data that we see today are really millions of individual measurements taken over a long period of time, over many points on the Earth's surface.
And those millions of data points, even if some of them have, let's say, failed devices or something like that, because there's so many of them, give you an accurate picture?
Yes, well, all of that is checked very carefully. There are data that are, of course, dropped out if there's something wrong with them. You don't always know that there's something wrong with them, and that's part of the errors that creep into the analysis. All of this has been subjected to a very intense scrutiny for possible errors, and at this point in time, we know about how big those errors are, and the temperature changes that we see are far exceeding the amount of error that's in the system.
Right, right. So what kind of temperature changes are we seeing in, let's say, the last 50 years, the last 10 years? What are we looking at?
Well, let me just look at a graph here of global mean surface temperature, which I have right in front of me. And since about 1850, temperature has risen about 0.8 degrees Celsius globally. That would be about 1.5 degrees on a Fahrenheit scale. Doesn't sound like much, but as one thinks about it, that's really quite a big difference.
That difference is the average of all these temperatures. Are some places experiencing greater temperature rises and others less?
Indeed so. The least amount of temperature rise is happening closer to the equator, and the most temperature rise is happening particularly around the North Polar region. At high latitudes, the Arctic Circle and above are experiencing temperature rise more than twice that much.
Why is that?
Well, a lot of it's due to the fact that rising temperatures are melting ice and snow, and that makes the Earth less reflective, and so it absorbs more sunlight at those latitudes.
Right, that's called the albedo effect.
That's correct, and that's one of the main reasons, and there are other things that creep in there and which aren't very well understood at this point, but there are air circulation issues that are involved as well, but those are very detailed meteorological considerations that we certainly aren't going to be going into on the Science Cafe.
Right, right. Now, what kinds of historical data do we have about the temperature of the Earth, and where does it come from?
Most of it, essentially all of it, that the public sees is taken either from surface stations on land or measurements that have been made of seawater by a variety of methods. Ships that measure seawater in the intake for the engine cooling, buoys, remote floats, and a variety of other devices have been used, so that most of the Earth's surface is now sampled pretty well. Wasn't as true in the past. That's why the errors in the measurements are larger if you go back in time. But now, all put together, the Earth's surface temperature is being measured to within a few hundredths of a degree Celsius.
You talk about surface temperature. Tell us also about temperature of, for example, deeper parts of the ocean and higher parts of the atmosphere. Those are presumably measured. What do they tell us about climate change?
Well, it tells us that changes are happening everywhere. And the ocean in particular is absorbing most of the heat from global warming simply because water has a large thermal mass. The surface of the ocean is rising rapidly in temperature, but at greater depths, it's rising very slowly. And that's mainly a consequence of the what we call the turnover time for ocean circulation, which is on the order of 1,000 years. So the bottom of the ocean doesn't know much about global warming yet. Eventually it will. So most of the warming in the ocean is happening at the surface, and less as you go down to depth. And in the atmosphere, there's rapid warming up to the near the middle troposphere and somewhat higher. And then when you get to the stratosphere, actually the temperatures are dropping somewhat. And actually that is a consequence of the same thing that's making the rest of the climate system get warmer.
How's that?
Well, there are two things that are going on there. And the one that's related to climate warming, and the best thing to do is think of it in the following way. Imagine that you throw a blanket over the Earth, and you can visualize how that would keep the surface warm and the temperature of the atmosphere down low would be made warmer. But that would also prevent radiation from the surface of the planet to warm the upper atmosphere, which is above our imaginary blanket. So that part of the air would cool off. And, of course, that's all related to the same process that's producing the warming at the surface. There's another process that's cooling the stratosphere, and that's the destruction of the ozone layer by chemicals that destroy ozone. And that has now reached its peak, and it hopefully will start tapering off now that certain chemicals are no longer being produced so rapidly from the surface in things that we do, like refrigerants and sterilizers and so forth.
We're talking to Donald Neidig from the National Solar Observatory, solar astronomer and astrophysicist. Now, in the presentation that you're going to be making next week, you talk about the climate system not only in terms of temperature, but also in terms of energy. What do you mean by that?
This is an essential reorientation that I believe everyone should be aware of. When one samples temperature, you're really not looking at the core of the subject. What's really happening in the climate system now is that there's an energy imbalance. We know why that's there. The fact that there's an energy imbalance leads to temperature rise, but it doesn't lead to a uniform temperature rise everywhere in the climate system because temperature can vary as heat is exchanged between air and ocean or between ocean and ice and so forth. So the key thing to look at is really the total energy that's been absorbed in the climate system. To get that, you have to be able to measure temperature changes and ice melt on the land surface, in the atmosphere, and in the ocean at all levels and depths. And this has been done.
Now, what kind of a picture does that give us when you reorient from temperature to energy?
the best way to look at it is to think of it in terms of the number of watts per square meter that the Earth is picking up. And if you do that, you see an increase starting back from whenever these measurements were first made, which I guess you could say 1950 is a good rough starting point, but better measurements are available after, let's say, 1970. So if you start from there and work forward, you see that the energy buildup in the climate system has been large, and today is something on the order of about 6/10 of a watt per square meter. Doesn't sound like much, but if you think of that spread over the whole Earth, and it's a steady input for a long time, it leads to very large changes. And one thing you can think of, just right off the cuff, is that that amount of energy input is equivalent to melting all of the Earth's ice in less than 1,000 years, which is an absolutely horrific amount of energy input. It won't happen because not all the energy is being concentrated on the poles, but the energy equivalent of what the Earth is picking up right now is severe enough to transform that much ice into liquid water.
How much of a sea level rise would that represent?
Well, it'll go several hundred feet, 200 to 300 feet, if that were to happen. We're not going to see that anytime soon. And in fact, under any scenario of global warming, you will find that not all of the ice caps would melt, but sea level rise of perhaps a meter by the end of this century is a distinct possibility.
Well, a meter sea level rise would mean really catastrophic consequences for example, coastal cities and coastal areas. Is that not correct?
I am not one who is into the consequences of all the impacts, but I guess you don't need to think too hard to realize that a meter change in sea level would be a great difficulty for many port cities that are at low sea level, and as well as millions of people that own property along the coast.
Now, your calculation of 6/10 of a watt per square meter, one thing that was interesting to me about the numbers that you have is that the increase in the late 20th century and then the increase in the early 21st century, we're still rising ever more rapidly. Is that correct in terms of this energy input onto the Earth's surface?
That seems to be the case, yes. It's not my calculation, by the way. It's the calculation of many studies that are all combined and summarized pretty well. And if anyone wants to read it, it's in the recent IPCC reports, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Now, what happens if we keep up at this pace? Let's say we burn every last bit of carbon, coal, gas, and oil, fossil fuels that are in the ground right now, that are still in the ground, and put them all in the air. What are we looking at in terms of energy, in terms of temperature?
Well, there are projections published by the IPCC. They, however, do not assume that all of the fossil fuels on Earth would be burned. I think the models that they run fold in some economic considerations about the cost of extraction of these fossil fuels in the future, and that there will be a tapering off of them, of the use of them, over the next couple of hundred years. But the worst-case scenarios are really bad. I really wonder myself. Let me back up a bit. Predicting the future is something that we really don't do with this topic. We make projections of what could happen in the future under a worst-case scenario and under a best-case scenario and something in between. And it's probably something in between that's going to happen. If you wanted to take a bet, that's probably where you would go. And what I see is that, from my own point of view, is that it looks like it's almost inevitable that the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide will be double its pre-industrial value sometime before another 100 years goes by. And if that happens, then Earth's mean temperature is going to go up about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a whole lot, and the changes are going to be quite significant, the downstream impacts. And I think that's enough to sober anyone. The worst-case scenarios are really horrible, and the best-case scenarios assume that the whole world's going to jump in and immediately and do something about it, and that doesn't seem too likely either. So an intermediate scenario is probably a good thing to look at, although one should be cognizant of what the worst and the best could be.
So when we look at that middle scenario, and we're looking at a 5-degree Fahrenheit temperature rise, what are the consequences of that?
Well, there are a host of them, and some of them we've already touched on here. The physical consequences of other than just temperature rise, there is, of course, the sea level rise and reduction in snow cover. As the atmosphere gets warmer, it will hold more water vapor. So the water vapor content in the atmosphere will rise, and that's going to lead to changes in weather patterns, precipitation events. We can also expect changes in ocean circulation patterns, additional carbon dioxide dissolving in seawater, which tends to reduce its pH, which most people call acidification of seawater, and changes in sea life perhaps as a result of that, changes in ocean salinity distribution and so forth. And those are the physical impacts. The social and economic impacts, again, is a separate topic. And it's important for us to separate the scientific questions from the policy-related questions. And when we get into impacts, you're into immediately the area of policymaking, which is interesting in itself, but it's not something that we concentrate on in a science cafe.
Right, and yet it's important because, of course, the young people who come to the science cafe are wanting to know what their lives might be like 20, 30, 40 years from now.
Well, absolutely. I'm going to put up a list of the impacts, and people are willing to question and discuss any of those, and some of the ones that you might think of that are really pretty obvious are, well, changes in where agriculture will take place, for example. If temperatures and precipitation pattern changes, where are they going to go? Just the cost of adaptation for some of these things are high. Like, for example, if a city is threatened by rising sea level, are they going to build dikes, seawalls? And these things are very expensive, so there's a cost. Some places in the world, human populations are just going to have to move, and that always creates problems when people leave one area and move into other areas where they may not be welcome or may not be room for them. There are health issues, changes in species distributions. There are some benefits, too. For example, the Arctic Ocean will become open to shipping and things like that. So it's a mixed bag, and people have looked at this for a number of years, and the overwhelming opinion is that the net consequences are not good, and they will be costly. And the bottom line on that is that it looks like it would probably be worth it to try to do something to reverse the effects. In other words, to put into effect mitigation activities that would slow the rise in temperature and eventually bring it to a halt.
It's interesting because, I mean, when you think about the entire history of evolution of life on this Earth, there have been climate changes and creatures have moved and migrated from one place to another. That, when you look at human populations with nations and borders and a kind of non-migratory lifestyle, by and large, is much, much harder.
That's correct. Yes, and then the geologic record certainly shows large changes in species distribution and extinctions and so forth that are correlated with rapid climate change in the past. And actually, those changes in the past weren't rapid compared to the ones we have now. The climate change we're seeing now is more rapid than anything that's documented in the past. It's absolutely horrific. We just haven't seen much of it yet. 100 years in a human lifespan is small compared to the geologic time scale.
Let's talk for a moment about methane. There's a lot of methane that is right now shielded from going into the atmosphere because of ice, because of permafrost. What happens when that melts? What are the consequences of that methane going into the air?
Methane concentrations in the air are much lower than carbon dioxide concentrations, and essentially what that means is that for any parcel of methane that you add right now, it produces a greater warming effect than an equal parcel of carbon dioxide. Now, the lifetime of methane in the atmosphere actually isn't very long. It oxidizes and actually becomes carbon dioxide. So it's kind of a double whammy. It produces a large effect when the methane is initially produced, but then after a while it converts to carbon dioxide and then it stays for centuries.
You are describing a scenario that astronomers, geologists, climate scientists, people who look at this data and know what it means, describe. I mean, the word you used a moment ago was horrific, very rapid. Yet the political response in the United States anyway is very small. What do you think is going on there?
Again, not my specialty, but I suspect that there's a lot of confusion on the part of the public now, and the public is kind of equally divided on accepting the idea of human-caused climate change and or not accepting it. And some of that is because there is confusion and a lot of misinformation is being bandied about. The Internet is just horrible. It's got anything from one side of the spectrum to the other. And it's very hard to make any sense of that. Also, to be completely honest, the economic and social impacts of global warming are really not entirely predictable because we've never seen it happen before. While we were on Earth, we don't really know exactly. Estimates can be made, and they're reliable to some extent, but the magnitudes are questionable. So that makes it look like, from the science point of view, that, well, we don't know what we're talking about. Well, we do know what we're talking about. We just don't have all the information to get the best answers that are possible at the present time. So these questions are easily taken as being introduced as, we don't know what's going to happen. But really we do, in a broad sense, and the specifics are known very well. Everyone knows that going green, as the word usually is presented, is going to represent some changes in lifestyle. Some people aren't going to like that. And for most people, climate change is not even visible to them. Look around. What do you see? Has it affected you much? Most people would say, no, it hasn't bothered me at all. So you roll all that together, and it's pretty hard to get a political mandate to do anything.
What it looks like to me when people say, has it bothered you so far, it's sort of like when you go into the doctor and the doctor says, look, you have a dime-sized aggressive tumor. And your response would be, well, that hasn't bothered me at all.
Yeah, well, that's right. I think public education is very important in this matter, which is why we're doing the cafe. And more involvement of the public with their representatives in Congress would help a lot.
What is your greatest hope for social responses to climate change?
Well, I would hope that we would start adopting some reasonable measures and start making a transition right now to using alternative energies and improving efficiencies. And I think those two things combined will actually allow us to mitigate a lot of the warming that's going to happen and improve our chances to adapt to the change that we're going to see. It's going to happen anyway, to some extent, no matter what you do, but we want to avoid crossing a threshold where it becomes really very difficult to cope with the changes. So I think a series of reasonable changes in our way we use energy and in the sources of energy would go a long way. And it's technically possible to do. It requires a commitment. And more than that, it requires a commitment from all other nations as well. And I think the United States, if we don't take the lead, we put ourselves in a very weak position of advocating that other nations should do the same.
Donald Neidig is a retired solar astronomer and astrophysicist from the National Solar Observatory. He will be speaking a week from today at 6 o'clock, leading a discussion called Understanding Global Warming. It's the first in this season's Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. It's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe. Starts at 6 in the evening. Admission is free, and refreshments will be served. Everybody is welcome, and seating preference is for the students. Thank you so much, Donald Neidig, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me.